From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, it's a two-part podcast exploring some of the ways the performing arts are being encouraged and presented in communities around the country. Later on in the show, I speak to Debbie Shapiro. She's the artistic director of the Marie Rader Presenting Series at Rowan University. But first, we hear from Adrian Arsht, a philanthropist who's taken a leading role in funding artistic growth in the three cities she calls home, Washington, D.C., Miami, Florida, and New York City. First, some background on Adrian. An attorney herself, she's the daughter of the first female judge in Delaware and a prominent Wilmington attorney. Adrian moved to New York City after law school, where she worked for Trans World Airlines. She settled in Washington, D.C. in 1979, where she started her own company, and then relocated to Miami in 1996 to run Total Bank, which she expanded from 4 to 14 locations. With the sale of the bank in 2007, philanthropy, which had always been a cornerstone, became her full-time occupation. While Adrian's philanthropy encompasses public policy, like, for example, funding the Adrian Arsht Latin America Center or the Adrian Arsht Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center, both at the Atlantic Council, the arts have always been central to her giving. I haven't the time to even touch on her extensive philanthropic cultural efforts, but I can give you some highlights. In 2008, her contribution of $30 million to the Miami Performing Arts Center literally prevented it from shutting its doors. Arsht is a trustee of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, where she established the Adrian Arsht Theater Fund, and she's a trustee emerita of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. In fact, in 2012, her contribution to Lincoln Center was recognized with the dedication of the Adrian Arsht Stage in Alice Tully Hall. She's a major funder of the Metropolitan Opera and an honorary trustee of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she funds the museum's first ever paid internship program. She's received many honors and awards for her work, including in 2017, the Carnegie Hall Medal of Excellence, recognizing her visionary and exceptional contributions to cultural and nonprofit institutions. The only woman ever to have received this distinction. When I spoke with Adrian Arsht, I asked her what inspired her giving, and most particularly, what inspired her giving to the arts. And by the way, Adrian and I spoke on two separate occasions, so you will hear a slight difference in the audio. Here's Adrian Arsht.
When I was growing up, my family made philanthropic contributions every year. At the end of the year, we sat down and my father and mother discussed where they thought the gift should go. My sister and I were asked for a vote. I think the arts define us as a civilization. I think the arts are essential to life. I have always thought that I'm blessed to have time here on earth, and it's a gift. And let's say I live in a very high rent district. I live wonderfully, and for that, I think I should pay a high amount of rent. And philanthropy, giving back, is the rent one pays for your time on earth. So that may be the background of why I gave to the arts.
Adrian's contribution to the Miami Performing Arts Center in 2008 gave it the necessary funds to continue its operations. But what I find remarkable is that Adrian wasn't responding to a plea for help. She was the one who picked up the phone to offer assistance. Adrian Arsht explains.
The Performing Arts Center in Miami had been open actually for 2 years, and it had been run by a very, very incompetent director. And he had effectively brought it to within a month of bankruptcy. And so I believed that if you just changed management, the rest was already there. And I had sold my bank. It was a community bank in Miami, so that it is of the community. The money that I made from it came from the community, and I felt I wanted to give back to the community some portion of the revenue that I got from the sale of the bank. And so very soon after the purchase or the sale closed, I was actually in Madrid meeting with the new owners, and I called a man named Woody Weiser, who had been at the beginning of the creation of a performing arts center, and he was chairman of the foundation which was raising the money, and said, what would it take to save the center? And we came to the conclusion that $30 million would do it. And I said that, and they cleaned everything up, got new management, and it's one of the strongest performing arts centers in the country. I believe that every great city, to be a great city, needs a performing arts center. I knew that Miami would support a performing arts center, and that certainly is the case. And from the beginning, it didn't really have to go for what do we have that's diverse. The Miami community is diverse, and all the programming there from the beginning has been about the entire community and the involvement of the community. Alvin Ailey comes every year, and a number of years ago it was scheduled to come to the Arts Center, and the presenting organization went bankrupt, so those of us at the Arts Center said we will internally fund it to bring them, make sure they can come. And Ailey does, in New York, summer camp, and it invites a number of students or young people to take dance class, learn what dance is. And they began their second one in Miami. It's now in, I think, 9 different cities. And actually, the White House and Michelle Obama presented to the Arts Center the Presidential Award for Community Service by creating Ailey Camp. It's an overused word, but I'd say transformative in the lives of so many people, and it's a natural in Miami.
The Arts Center remains deeply involved with arts education throughout Miami-Dade County.
Arts education, I would say, is sadly now a requirement in the private sector. It used to be in schools we could do that, but now it has become, if you will, a responsibility of a community. And in Miami, the Adrian Arsh Center's flagship project on arts education is called Learning Through the Arts. And it was started with the 5th grade in the public school system, and Miami-Dade County has, I think it's the 4th largest school system in America. And we created the idea of the plan that every 5th grader would be able to attend a performance at the Arts Performing Arts Center. And the children were bused to that place. They were given backstage tours and taught about what a performing arts center is and a performance is. And this was broadened to include all those in the 7th grade, and then most recently, all those in the 9th grade, so that now every child will have attended a performance. And each year the arts center creates a musical, and the children see how that is created, and then they experience it.
Adrienne's eye is always fixed on the future, as evidenced by her funding a groundbreaking paid internship program at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And her reasons for doing it were deeply personal.
It came specifically because of something involving my father. He lived in Wilmington, Delaware, and he was at Penn Law School. And he was a superb student, and his grades made him eligible for law review, and he was invited to become a part of that. However, he needed to earn money to pay his tuition, and so he had to turn down being on the law review so he could hitchhike back to Wilmington for a job to earn money to be able to continue his studies. Now, he did superbly, But we all know that having law review on your resume, being on the law review offers you opportunities for judicial clerkships, offers you access to people and situations that without it you would not have. And so it was so clear to me, or almost like nails on a blackboard, the situation with my father. And an internship should be a step up, not a stumbling block. And so that was behind it. And right after the George Floyd tragedy, the Met Museum listed about 15 things that it was committed to do, one of which was to fund interns. And I called them and said, I'll do that. And it was within 24 hours of their publishing their wish list. And the excitement from that, or the pleasure that gives to me, the next class cohort of people who applied were more than 300% more in number, because once you remove the barrier of having to do it for free when you had to earn money, it became an option for so many other people. We reached out to the historically black colleges. We reached out to the Jackie Robinson Foundation and just said, make sure that your alums and your students know about this. So what also became evident within the first year is that the quality or dedication or interest of these students that would not have been able to do the internship without being paid was at a very high caliber. They were there because they really wanted to learn. The interest is so much greater when you're there with a purpose. And what all the curators found, it's really been something delightful from my standpoint. Curators, as I'm moving around the museum at various times, all come up to me and thank me because the interns that they have gotten have just been so stellar. And quite a number of the interns now get offered a paid position when they're finished their schooling. And what I made sure of is that the interns were put into the administrative departments, not just the painting or sculpture or Greek this, but to go into development, to go into the legal department. I made sure that the president and the managing director each had at least one intern. And so now there's a cohort, after quite a number of years, of young people who would not, up until now, been able to apply for these kinds of positions. And so the ability to have a new demographic available throughout, it doesn't have to be the arts to be in the development department. You can be in a hospital. There's so many areas throughout the Met, and they are given a lot of instruction while they're there. And then I replicated that in Miami at the Adrian Arsh Center for the Performing Arts. And now all of their interns are paid.
Adrian tends to fund performing arts programs, including an innovative program at the Metropolitan Museum of Art called MetLive Arts. Adrian Arsh explains.
Two-dimensional things are not my area of interest, skill, or knowledge. In the creative arts, other than the performing arts, items made out of non-traditional objects, whether it's Deborah Butterfield, who uses railroad ties and branches to build a horse, and other things I am fascinated by and collect. But the museum, in its traditional sense, has never been of interest to me. But the Live Arts, which Limor Tomer runs, is using everything in the museum to tell a story about something. He wanted to get it so that people see things, shall I say, much more horizontally than in silos. So somebody dances in the Temple of Dendur, or they took different vessels, pots, from throughout the museum, and all pots have a sound, and they wired them or put mics in 30 different pots and created a symphony. So that was my interest.
A theme Adrian returns to time and time again is resilience.
Resilience has always been something of interest to me, and how that is represented in a museum or almost anywhere is something that fascinates me. I've made a gift to the Smithsonian about building a sustainable community, which is a slightly other way of saying finding out how things are resilient, what are resilient, and how do we save those that seem to become endangered. And in this process, the Smithsonian is going to all of its museums and asking each one to submit one item in their collection that they think exemplifies resilience, such that you can find a resilient object in every one of the different museums.
All of Adrienne Arsht's giving is personal. It comes from her. She does not operate through a foundation.
I guess I can't even imagine why you'd have a foundation. It's just a lot of bureaucratic requirements. It wouldn't benefit me at this point to have an entity. For others, I'm sure there are very good reasons, and when you have billions of dollars, you need to set up an entire system. On my death, the Adrienne Arsht Foundation then comes into being, and everything that I own now is held as trustee for the foundation. So on my death, everything I own goes into a foundation.
So how does she make her philanthropic decisions?
Where I see an ability to be a game changer, that's really where I go. When I first came to Washington in 1979, there still is an organization called KCPI, the Kennedy Center Productions, Inc., and it was founded to bring theater to the Kennedy Center because the Kennedy Center was 4 years old at the time and nobody had put it on their schedule. So I, along with Roger Stevens, the chairman of the Kennedy Center, together worked this through. I helped start an organization in New York called TACT, the Actors Company Theater, and it was a new way of presenting theater in a bit of an ensemble format. So I look for things that, whether it's the Performing Arts Center in Miami, that others may not see with such optimism, and so I'm willing to risk it and fund it.
But Adrienne Arsht is also quick to caution.
Something, though, that's very important to remember, funders should write checks, not run programs. And you fund something that you believe in, but the people who are running it are the experts. That's why they're running it. So I am very clear that I have absolutely nothing to do with the product of anything. People want to know, can you put on my play? Or, gee, would you talk to my son? He wants to be in this. And I say, here's the director of programming. And the director of programming knows that I have nothing to do with it. And the parent will write to that person and say, Adrienne said that you would audition my son. And it is totally known in-house that that's not true. I will not have anything to do with the product, and it's the same way with the Arsht Latin America Center or the Arsht Rock Resilience Center. The program, the conferences, the things that are studied in any aspect of either of those, I have absolutely nothing to do with. And I think no donor should have anything to do with the product.
But Adrienne does want her name on programs and centers that she funds. naming is critical for her.
I think it's very important to tell people what matters to you and what you stand for. When it comes to naming, women do not, will not put their name on things. They don't think it's appropriate. They tend to be upset with, I say this personally, women upset with me because they felt I was bragging by putting my name on something. Men are the exact opposite. I wish more women put their name on things and saw its value. I think the old silly expression, but to put your money where your mouth is, or put your mouth where your money is, and to tell people what matters. And if they respect you, this will draw them to that.
The chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, Maria Rosario Jackson, advances the concept of artful lives. And I was curious, when Adrian thinks about the idea of an artful life, what five or six words come to her mind?
I've given that some thought, and I think essential things are to be optimistic, to be courageous, to be impatient, to be resilient in the sense of the show must go on, and to be generous.
That was philanthropist Adrian Arsht. We'll have a link to some of the programs she funds in our show notes. This is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. When we come back, it's a focus on Glassboro, New Jersey, and the Marie Rader Presenting Series at Rowan University. Welcome back. You're listening to Artworks from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. And now a look at arts presenting in Southern New Jersey. Glassboro, New Jersey is the home to Rowan University, which in 2008 established the Marie Rader Presenting Series. This brings award-winning artists to the area with an eye on engaging with the campus community and the people of South Jersey, and creating programming as diverse as the area itself. Creating what artistic director Debbie Shapiro hopes will be a transformative experience on and off campus. Here's Debbie Shapiro to tell us more about the series.
Over the past 15 years, Rowan University has put approximately 50 Marie Rader series presentations on our campus stages, reflecting a wide range of musical, movement, and theatrical forms. And these public performances have brought together a vibrant cross-section of Rowan students, alumni, faculty, staff, and arts lovers from a broad geographic region, including the southern and central New Jersey counties, Philadelphia, and the surrounding suburbs of Pennsylvania, and sometimes drawing from even farther away. Recently, the Marie Rader series has expanded to offer programming for young audiences, which is an initiative dear to our hearts as educators first. And beyond the stage, every Marie Rader series artist works with Rowan students directly to provide coaching, and each artist engages with general public audiences through meet and greets, panel discussions, lecture demonstrations, and more.
You're not only housed on a campus, you're housed at the School of Performing Arts, correct?
That's right.
Well, explain that relationship between the series and the School of Performing Arts a bit more.
Right. So unlike most university-based presenters who operate separately from their academic counterparts, the Marie Rader series is integrated within the College of Performing Arts. And so the College of Performing Arts offers already a wide variety of undergraduate and graduate degree programs in dance, music, and theater. And so the decisions around the artists that we engage through the Marie Rader series are informed by that, by an ongoing dialogue with our faculty, an awareness of what our students might benefit most from being exposed to, as well as considering what might be beneficial for a wider population.
And how many performances does the series offer a year? I'm assuming you sort of work within an academic year.
We do for now. We have goals to expand. There is a growing demand for summer programming, and we are not there yet. So as you said, really between the months of September and December, and then again, late January through April, those are really our windows. And we will present anywhere between three complex engagements to sometimes we've been able to work six to nine, you know, if they're smaller, because we, like everyone, have budgetary restrictions and also space limitations. But going into this year, we're focusing on three major companies to perform on our stages. They're all going to be pretty big impact in performance and engagement off the stage as well.
Well, before we get a sneak peek at who you're bringing in for the new season, diversity is so important to this series. If you simply look at the people who have come to campus to perform, the university is diverse, the area is diverse.
That's
so
right.
In 2022, for example, you presented the Axis Dance Company, which is an ensemble of disabled and non-disabled performers, the Urban Bush Women, which is a legendary African-American dance group, and Eighth Blackbird, a contemporary music sextet. This is broad programming. So how do you curate the series to engage such a broad range of artistic experiences for your audiences on campus and often to inspire the kind of engagement you're looking for?
Broad and balanced is what we're working for. And really, the curatorial process is, it's built from a ton of conversations at every level. So between performances, I'm meeting with and talking with my colleagues in the college, learning about student interests, working with community groups, and as well as fellow presenters, artists, and agents, right? They all make up this ecosystem of touring and presenting. And being actively engaged at every level of dialogue is how we understand where we are, what's possible, and what might create the most impact within a limited budget, which we need to use to achieve a sense of balance. And the top criteria for balance that I'm always looking at are a nice representation of artistic form that builds from all that we teach and represent here academically, as well as expanding upon that with what we don't quite cover in our academic curriculum, but that can fill in and bolster what we do. And then beyond artistic form, we have cultural identity. There's so much history, right, and context that informs the work that we see on the stage today. And so finding that mix, understanding that we're seeing a changing and growing population here in Glassboro because of the expansion of the university. So we want to reflect that in our programming, which should look as diverse as we know the region's population is.
Let's touch on the all-important question of money. How is the series funded?
The series is made possible in part through generous support from the Henry M. Rowan Family Foundation via the Marie Rader Memorial Fund and through funds from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, which is a partner agency of the National Endowment for the Arts. And we are very, very grateful for those partnerships.
Collaboration often plays a really significant role in the performing arts. And I wonder if you can tell us about any notable collaborations or partnerships that the series has fostered with organizations or other educational institutions?
Sure. So in terms of partnering off campus, that is something that we're really in the early stages of building, though we have seen some early successes. I let the artists lead. In terms of researching and selecting artists to come visit our region, we're looking at, you know, what do they have that's ready to perform on the stage? And then what do they offer that's also just sort of ready to go, where we could bring them anywhere and help those artists help us to build our own partnerships. An example from last season was the Grammy-winning chamber ensemble Third Coast Percussion. They're a percussive quartet really leading in new contemporary music. And not only did they have provide an electrifying performance, we brought them to an elementary school in Marlton, New Jersey, because they have an assembly program that they called Think Outside the Drum. It's sort of a music education lesson and a demonstration of all that is percussion. And we were lucky that we found a huge reception among that school, among the music educators, the principal, the superintendent of that district. They just really got it. They welcomed us. It was easy to schedule. We brought those artists in front of about 250 second through fifth graders of that school. We then offered all of those families free tickets to come to the performance that was going to take place in our concert hall. And we did see some nice response there because it was the children that were inspired through that assembly. And what we were saying was, we're not asking you for any money. We are asking you for a little bit of time to follow up on something exciting that your child experienced at school today. And so we want to continue with that type of model. We are really aggressively working to open our doors wide and invite folks in and introduce ourselves and create that brand awareness in all directions throughout our region. And it includes a lot of bringing artists to other spaces, making sure that we've provided something not only for free, but really enriching that works within standards of education and curriculum, and that the educators in those institutions are going to be easily enthusiastic about. And then from there, being able to give another gift, right? Another invitation that is, again, free access, because we know that it starts with early exposure and we've got to remove as many barriers as we can. So similarly, this year, we're going to try the same thing with Arturo O'Farrell and bring him to Millville High School for, again, a little demonstration, maybe visiting some music classes. And we hope that those families will then want to check out what we have going on in Glassboro. So public schools are a key partner for us. We also look at other types of community organizations. I've been having some exchanges over the years with the Glassboro Boys and Girls Club, which is located just down the street from our venue and yet serves a population that we're not seeing in our concert hall very much. And so we've worked to offer free tickets for years, and yet just offering free tickets, we've learned that's not enough. You'd think that sounds like a great deal. And yet what we have to do is bring our artists to their spaces, offer some sort of exchange, workshop, demonstration, light up those participants and get them talking about what happened and how can they get more of that. And from there, we hope to see some more redemption of, again, free ticket offers. And we hope that by traveling to all the other spaces where folks are already comfortable gathering, that they will recognize that they can go even further by just coming and visiting us. And hopefully when they do, they have an equally comfortable, welcoming, and exciting experience.
As you say, you began a series for young audiences. How important do you think it is for people to have arts experiences when they're young in order to really be able to embrace the arts as an adult?
It's so important that we continue to develop unique, high-quality family programming for young audiences, so that we're not only serving the surrounding families today, but we're also planting the seeds to develop the audiences of the future who we hope will look back and have formative memories with us, because there is so much possibility that could stem from that, ranging from just having that memory to more specific and serious commitment to participation and practice in the arts and pursuing careers and everything in between.
Okay, so we've hinted at it. Now it's time to explore it. Let's take a peek at what is coming up at the Marie Rader presenting series this season. What can audiences look forward to?
So we've got two big themes: prioritizing cultural diversity and environmental sustainability. And so we were lucky to secure a touring project called Rising Tide, the Crossroads Project, and that will be coming in September. And that's a collaborative performance from the Fry Street Quartet with physicist Dr. Robert Davies, hailing from Utah. And they pair original music, stunning visuals, environmental photography, and scientific prose, not theatrical prose, but scientific prose, through a performance to convey the impact of climate change and activate the audience to determine their part in sustaining the planet. And so I'm so excited to be able to find a performance that we can feature in our series that gets audiences to take steps beyond what we normally do, right? We normally provide joy, inspiration, excitement, and education. And this one is taking a step further and taking part in a larger conversation at Rowan, which is incredibly interdisciplinary and involves all kinds of scholars in finding solutions to, right, our world's biggest threat. So that's how we're kicking off the season. And then from there, we are going to move into some celebratory works that feature Latin performers. And so in November, we're very excited to be bringing the New York-based tap and live music ensemble Music from the Soul. They will be performing their newly completed work, I Didn't Come to Stay, in which tap, percussive dance, samba, house, and live music come together, and they are exploring tap's lineage and connection to other Afro-diasporic forms. And they are really masters in transforming a space with such heightened joy, and this particular piece feels like you are being transported to a Brazilian carnival. So I'm so excited to share it with our public.
And you also mentioned Arturo O'Farrell.
That's right. So then coming up in January, we are bringing Arturo O'Farrell and the entire 18-piece Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra. And he's a master Latin jazz educator. He founded the Afro-Latin Jazz Alliance, which is now getting its new permanent home in New York City. He's a band leader, composer, and pianist, widely celebrated. And he's not a stranger to New Jersey, though this will be the Rowan/Glassboro premiere of the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra performance. So we do have quite a history of jazz study and presenting here at Rowan. Latin jazz is something that it's about time that we kind of embrace as well. And so I feel that we couldn't have made a better choice. And that's coming up in January. And as more engagements are planned, we'll be announcing those a little later down the road. But those are the confirmed projects at this time.
All of the performers conduct master classes. Is that true?
That's true. So we do. We ask a lot of artists in a short amount of time because, you know, we value their time. We host them for as long as we can, you know, compensate and take good care of everyone. But within the couple days, really, that most artists are in our town, we ask them both for a performance and master classes. Usually it's one, but sometimes it's two or three, you know, if it is a musical ensemble, and we can divide them up among the studios of the specific instruments, we'll do that. And then we want to bring them off campus. We work on a tight schedule, and we keep our artists really busy, and we often feel incredibly full upon the completion of an engagement, and often we then see an open door that we didn't see before that artist came here, in terms of those partnerships, in particular with those off-campus groups.
Well, Debbie, what is your vision for the Marie Rader presenting series? When you think, but you know, when you're looking ahead, what's your vision for it?
So we're seeking to bring the best possible artistry from the nation and the globe to Rowan. We want to connect South Jersey to world-class performers and build on the recent successes we've had. I'm looking at depth along with breadth, which means really pursuing how could we bring back artists every few years? I can't think of a single engagement that we've had where I wouldn't want to bring those artists back. And we've begun so many stories together and what conversations might happen if we continue. So there's a depth there for the audience in building recognition, right? But there's also a need for long-term artist-presenter relationships in terms of a sustainable touring model for career artists. And we're both committed to developing community and audience around the work, but also sustaining the artists themselves. I know how challenging it can be to piece together your annual income when you're relying on these engagements to pay everyone in your company. Like I said, it's also important to continue the family programming aspect. And I also imagine that the series could become the glue for two communities at the same time. So on one hand, we can really develop interdisciplinary relationships within our university and harness that incredible hive mind of scholarly expertise across the many colleges and fields that we're supporting here with this institution, while we're also bringing folks together throughout the region in our venues. And like many other transformative initiatives led by Rowan, The Marie Rader series is poised to become the most inspiring and welcoming performing arts series in the region, hopefully impacting generations of individuals. And we have great possibility. We have a beautiful 800-seat concert hall, plus smaller indoor and outdoor spaces. We feel a responsibility to contribute to the economic and cultural vibrancy of Glassboro. And the current tagline for the series is experience transformative performances and intimate engagements with a world-class lineup of living legends, award winners, provocateurs, and movement leaders, bringing South Jersey together and moving cultural conversations forward through performing arts programming. I really think it can be eye-opening to experience a performance by an artist you don't have a history with through that opening up and being willing to take part in different audience communities. It can be a portal to curiosity and inspiration. And that's what the vision for the series is all about.
And one more time, when does the series begin?
So the very first engagement for this year, Rising Tide, the Crossroads project that I was describing earlier, that performance is on September 22nd, and then performances follow about once a month or every other month after that.
And how can people get more information?
So our website is go.rowan.edu/Marie Rader Series.
Okay, and we'll have a link in our show notes. Debbie, thank you so much for giving me your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Debbie Shapiro, the artistic director of the Marie Rader Presenting Series at Rowan University. We'll have a link to the series in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a rating on Apple, because it does help other people who love the arts to find us. And I love hearing from you. The email is artworkspod@arts.gov. I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.